Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. With Florida's 2014 legislative session now just a month away, we kick off our series of conversations with members of Southwest Florida's legislative delegation. I caught up with Republican State Representative Matt Caldwell on a recent visit to Florida Gulf Coast University. Caldwell represents State House District 79, which includes portions of North Fort Myers, Lehigh Acres, and Buckingham. Let's listen now to that conversation for a look at Caldwell's legislative priorities heading into the session. And to start off, I wanted to ask, last year the legislature decided not to take federal money to expand Medicaid. And I know that that's an issue that's going to be coming back up again. Miami State Senator Rene Garcia has refiled his bill to basically do that. It's going to be a tough sell in the House, though, I would imagine. What is your position on that?
Sure. And that's, you know, that's a topic we took about 8 months to study. So trying to boil that down into a couple minutes for your listeners is tough. But the long and short is that we did study all the ins and outs of the proposal as presented to us by the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. And ultimately, the House decided that that really wouldn't meet the needs of our population that's looking to be served with that program. And we proposed an alternative that would have provided an insurance subsidy, basically, to allow folks below the poverty line that aren't currently covered by old Medicaid the ability to buy private insurance for themselves and receive the same kind of benefit that you or I, who receive employer-based coverage, get. Ultimately, we weren't able to work out those details with the Senate. I think, as you mentioned, it will come back up. Senator Garcia has refiled the bill to consider the ACA version as written, and we'll have to continue to have that discussion on the best way to move forward for those folks.
And if not supporting, Senator Garcia's version, would you still be in favor of some sort of expansion? I mean, not quite as expansive as what would have happened under the ACA, but, you know, something that would address, you know, perhaps some of those folks who are going to be in that spot where they earn too much to qualify for Medicaid as it stands now, but earn too little to qualify for subsidies through healthcare.gov.
Sure, and by and large, the portion, the population that's in the Medicaid expansion pool really doesn't fall into that category. There are folks who do exceed the 100% threshold, but most of the folks that we're talking about in that population are below 100% of poverty. And there's really two groups. There's some folks that are certainly qualifying under the traditional vision of a safety net, parents with children, individuals who have either a developmental or a physical disability, and for whatever reason they're falling through the cracks of traditional Medicaid right now. But most of the folks in the expansion pool are people who are unemployed. There really isn't a gradient of folks between 0% of poverty and 100% of poverty. It's either you have a job or you don't. Right. And as soon as you do get a job, you're going to move into the subsidy system of the new ACA structure. And so our focus, first and foremost, it'd be hard to miss. We've been talking about jobs nonstop, and we've definitely been outpacing the rest of the country in terms of getting people back to work here in the state. That is going to do more long-term for a person than any kind of program really can. A person who's back to work and helping to contribute to the better and greater society, that's our ultimate goal.
And looking a little, you know, more broadly here as far as the legislative session, the economic recovery is slow, but it is bringing in increased state revenue. Do you think that's going to create an easier path towards passing a budget?
Absolutely. We're going to look to have about another $1 billion come in from the growth in sales and our sales tax. That's the primary driver of our state budget. We're going to have a healthy debate about what to do with those extra dollars. I think your listeners have probably seen the proposals to consider rolling back some of the taxes and fee structure, but also a lot of discussion about natural resource questions. Those of us that live in Southwest Florida recognize the difficult times we faced last summer with the heavy rainfall, and a lot of proposals out there right now to invest a good chunk of that money in water resource projects.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to mention that, how the summer rains really brought that to the forefront, especially issues with the integrity of the aging Herbert Hoover Dike, water discharges down the Caloosahatchee River, its relation to, red tide, toxic algae blooms. But as far as, things like the Herbert Hoover Dike go, do you think we've seen enough commitment from the federal side as far as, you know, maintaining that infrastructure and protecting our water resources.
Well, that's really the rub when it comes to the Everglades restoration project and the greater ecosystem. There's a number of pieces of that system where it's a cost share and an operational share between the state and the federal government. And at times, the federal government has not lived up to its 50-50 commitment that was agreed to in the year 2000. It's presented some very strange problems for us operationally as a state in how we're able to manage the resource when we've got to share some of that control. And I think you have seen some positive signs recently in D.C. They've passed the policy side of the bill that would fund the rehabilitation of the dike, but they still have to put the money to that. Branching off from that thought, that's why my focus this coming session is really going to be about those parts of the system that we don't share operational control with the federal government, but we have 100% decision-making authority. And I'm going to really be placing a high priority on projects, particularly in our own basin, that we can fund and build and get done in a horizon that is 2 or 3 years, and we're able to fast-track because we don't have to wait for money or authority from the federal government.
Do you think some of those, the funding for some of those projects could come from the $130 million Governor Scott has recently called on for Everglades restoration projects?
That's certainly going to be part of the discussion. I mean, you've seen the governor put forward what he would like to see us put that money towards. I think you'll see some really good contributions in that discussion from the House and the Senate. You know, everybody's got their own particular idea of what's the best project. But ultimately, I think the product of that discussion is going to be beneficial for all of Florida.
And kind of sticking with your role as chair of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Subcommittee, Florida's $9 billion citrus industry is facing a big threat now from greening. It seems to be growing into more and more groves. And in fact, it's predicted that we're going to have the smallest citrus crop this year in 24 years due in large part to greening. Is that something that you think the legislature will take up in March?
Yes, I think you'll see us continue our commitment to research funding at the IFAS centers through the University of Florida and the larger extension system. It's critical that we find solutions to address this disease problem that's devastating our groves. Citrus is a major part of our economic picture. It's certainly something that we're not unique in dealing with. It's a disease issue is rampant in Brazil and California and in the places that we compete with for that business. So everyone's struggling under the weight of that burden. But our commitment's, I think, going to be continued and robust from the state level to solve that issue.
And I know pension reform is going to be another issue that's going to come up this session. House Speaker Will Weatherford, I believe, is again going to be pushing to end the pension system that we have now in exchange for more of a 401k style system for state employees. Is that something you'd support?
Yeah, the speaker has put forward a very robust and forward-thinking idea that we move out of the pension business altogether at the state level. Mm-hmm. You know, pensions are really, from my perspective, an antiquated artifact of tax law from the 1940s. The ability of individuals to own their money and decide how to invest their funds really is a much more appropriate way, I think, to manage our retirement dollars, particularly when you consider how few people continue to work for any kind of agency for more than 5 or 10 years. Putting all of your eggs in the one basket of that agency to take care of you in retirement, I think, really is unwise for the individual worker. So the proposal, it's 401k style is what they say. It's a 403b is the proposal, and that would be the same investments that the state uses in the pension, but it would let those workers decide which part of the investment pool they want to put their money in. And really what it would do immediately is re-enfranchise more than half of the employees, because as it is now, less than half of the folks that go to work for the state stay there long enough to vest in the pension. So going to a 403B would allow them to actually take some kind of retirement from their time at the state when they move on to a different career.
Gotcha. So, I mean, and the state pension fund, I should mention, it's very healthy. But for you, that's not what it's about. It's more of an ideological difference. It's about, giving people more control over how to invest their own funds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the promises we've made in the past to those employees that came to work for us and did give us those 20 and 30 years worth of service, they deserve to expect a fully funded and healthy pension and a retirement as described when they signed on the dotted line. But moving forward, that dynamic really just isn't the way the world is going. There's very, very few private businesses that are constructing that kind of retirement system anymore. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I would submit to the folks that are the workers that you benefit by being able to take control of your own destiny rather than be dependent on the decisions, good or bad, of in this case, politicians. And we've seen plenty of examples around the country where the bad decisions have led to bankruptcies in their pensions. And thank God we don't have that because of our good decisions here. But that guarantee is only as good as the next election sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Gambling could be another hot-button issue during this legislative session. You know, the state's exclusive gaming contract with the Seminole Tribe expires in 2015. There's been interest even in last year's session into, you know, paving the way towards, you know, Vegas-style destination-type gambling operations. Is that something you think that could be good for Florida, or is that something you would oppose?
Well, ultimately, gambling for me falls in the same category as the regulation of alcohol or tobacco. That really is a decision that should be more local in my mind. You know, there's counties still in Florida and North Florida that have blue laws, and you're not able to buy alcohol on Sundays. And that's a decision that community has made for themselves. When you look at a state as big and diverse as Florida, I do think there's opportunities for people to have different kinds of lifestyles and decisions in their community. Ultimately, my position has been when it comes to Lee County and our role in that larger scheme, if ultimately the decision is to expand the gaming universe, then I want to make sure Lee County has an opportunity to choose whether or not we want to be a part of that, not be left in the cold in terms of even being able to participate if we wanted to.
I also wanted to turn to another measure that you've sponsored, urging Congress to take action to amend the U.S. Constitution to impose term limits on U.S. House and Senate members. Why is that why do you think federal lawmakers should have term limits? I mean, we do have them here for state legislators.
Sure. Well, first, it's a very popular issue. If you look when we voted on it here in Florida back in the early 90s, it was approved with around 70% of the vote. It consistently polls well over two-thirds wherever it's presented around the country. And I don't think it takes much to explain to people that as much as experience may be a help in understanding some of the more complex problems we face, entrenched politics is not the best scenario for the health of our country. We've got folks really who have been there so long, they feel like it's their birthright, really, that they own the seat, not the people that they represent. And at the end of the day, each one of those seats in Congress belong to the 600,000 or so folks who live in those seats, not the member. The member is merely a vessel. Incumbency is a powerful thing. It certainly discourages robust competition for those that say, well, you get a choice every 2 years. Well, you have to have a choice to make a choice. And by and large, the history of incumbency will show that the choices become diminished over time with the strength and power of the member. So I certainly have no problem serving in the era of term limits. I think it's a good thing. And I think it would make the debate and the process in Washington, D.C. healthier than it is today.
And another bill that you've co-sponsored dealing with the federal government would make an application to Congress to call Article 5 Convention to propose amendments to the U.S. Constitution for the purpose of imposing fiscal restraint, limiting federal government power. Tell us about the impetus behind that.
Sure. I think and I would encourage any of the listeners that may be wondering, hey, where is that really coming from? Just take a moment and go back and read the Constitution. Read Article 1, which lays out the power of the congressional authority. And ask yourself how many things Congress involves itself in today that you don't see authorized in Article 1. Now, ultimately, it may be that the things Congress involves itself in today is the wise decision, and as a people, we want them to do those things. But I would submit that many of them aren't authorized by the Constitution, and operating outside of the law is not going to be healthy in the long run for a people who have staked our future on self-governance. This method of calling for a convention to address problems that the states view have developed over the years with Congress, it was laid out in the Constitution as an option. And I think the folks that are worried about the trillions of dollars of debt we have, really the seeming inability for either side of the debate to come together and address that question, really demands that we get together and focus on some kind of limits to how the Congress is able to develop all of these things. You know, you've got states like ours that are fiscally solvent, that meet our budgets every year, that have paid down in the last few years $300 million in debt. We're going the right direction on that. It's really not that hard when you get down to it, and I think this would be a good vehicle to call them to account to really let's start addressing these fundamental issues.
Yeah, and from what I understand, you know, this is, you know, more than about just getting this measure through the Florida legislature, but rather I think it's 33 additional states would also have to pass something similar in order to enact that Article 5 convention. Is that something you think is likely to happen?
It's certainly possible, and you won't know until you try for sure. There are, I think, approaching the requisite number of states to have these kind of motions filed. And ultimately, as you say, they have to all go to completion through their own chambers. The number is 34 out of the 50 states have to make that application, and I believe it'll be a healthier federal government if we're able to go through that process.
And there was one other bill that you had sponsored that I was very curious about because it's maybe just a line of work I know very little about, but a bill that would pave the way for the creation of the Florida Concrete Masonry Education Council. What is that, and why is that something that Florida needs?
Sure. Well, it's no secret that one of our big industries in Florida, even after the downturn in the economy, is construction. Mm-hmm. We house the future, so to speak. It's what's driving the continued growth and leading us to be the third biggest state. But after that experience of the large boom in the mid-decade, a number of the concrete block manufacturers have approached the legislature and indicated that, you know, it may sound simple, but really laying concrete block and building houses correctly is a skill, and it's a skill that can garner you a high wage. And what they would like to do is help facilitate that kind of training throughout our workforce development regions in the state. We have all kinds of skills training programs, and they'd like to see concrete block masonry work added to those programs. Ultimately, there's a part of federal law that would subject the multiple manufacturers to a concern about monopoly interaction. And so what this bill does is relieves them of that accusation and standardizes a way for them to donate a penny per block to fund that kind of training.
And, you know, one of the other big contentious issues that could be coming up again would be relating to Florida's Stand Your Ground law. You know, the state and the nation still seem pretty divided on the verdict of the, you know, George Zimmerman case in the death of Trayvon Martin. There have been measures proposed to repeal or modify the Stand Your Ground law. Where do you stand on that issue?
Sure. You know, the legislature appointed a standing committee to investigate how that law was applied in general, and in particular some of the cases where it's been more controversial. Ultimately, I think if you talk to the majority of those members, they would tell you that the problem isn't with the construction of the law, it's with the application at the local jurisdictions. And really where the gap may be most critical is in making sure both the judiciary and the local prosecutors really have an understanding of what that law is allowed to protect a citizen from and what it's not. And there are plenty of cases, the more outrageous ones you've heard people mention, where it should not have been utilized or even allowed in the court as a defense. And that's really what we're going to have to continue to focus on. I mean, fundamentally, I think most people in the state would agree that you know, if your grandmother's at home and someone invades her home, and she's in fear of her life, she shouldn't be ultimately prosecuted if the decision she made in that very difficult and heated moment is to fire a weapon to try to save what she thought was her life in danger at that moment. It's really, as I said, comes down to application rather than the words of the law.
And there's this threatened use of force bill that I see you've co-sponsored. Is that in any way a modification of Stand Your Ground, or does that relate to another issue altogether?
Well, it's to the 10/20 life and the use of a firearm if you ultimately get charged with a felonious act. And really what this comes down to is if you brandish a weapon unnecessarily under our current concealed weapons law, you can be charged with a crime. It's a very high standard that you have to meet as a person who decides to get a concealed weapon license and use that privilege. But if in the moment you fire a warning shot to try to deter an intruder, again, kind of going back to the last conversation, instead of making the decision to possibly harm your attacker, your would-be attacker, you merely fire a warning shot, we don't think that person, if it's a true situation where that was the case, should be subject to having that count towards some kind of 10/20 life charge. And that's it's one of the quirks that come out of trying to figure out how best to allow people to express the right of self-defense without getting them caught up in the dragnet of larger criminal prosecution.
And we've covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time here, but are there any other, you know, as you speak with constituents in your district, are there issues you hear from them the most that you would like to address, or anything else that you would like to address as we prepare to head into the 2014 legislative session?
Well, I would think in Southwest Florida, overwhelmingly it's the water issues that we had this summer, and you know, there's no doubt we face some very difficult circumstances going from the rainiest summer since 1947 right into the driest October since 1911. I mean, that's the kind of back and forth seesaw that we deal with. Most everywhere else on this latitude on Earth is a desert. We're blessed to have a lot of rain, but sometimes it's too much. And that's going to really be a large part of our focus, and my focus in particular with my chairmanship on natural resources, to try to get some real projects out of the ground, not just continue to talk about what we know we need to do, but let's get some boots on the ground. And as a commissioner of agriculture, Putnam says, more ribbon cuttings and less ground breakings would be what we need to get forward.
Well, Representative Caldwell, thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
That was Republican State Representative Matt Caldwell, representing State House District 79, which includes portions of North Fort Myers, Lehigh Acres, and Buckingham in Lee County, talking about his legislative priorities for the coming legislative session. Tune into future editions of the program to hear more voices from members of Southwest Florida's legislative delegation. That's all the time we have for today's show. There's more information on the program, as well as an archive of past shows at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. To comment on anything you've heard on this or any edition of the show, send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to my producers Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.